face. From the quaint costume of this newcomer, his collar of magnificent lace, and a certain serene gravity in his bearing, the first arrival thought that this personage must be either patron or friend of the court painter. He stood aside, therefore, upon the landing to allow the visitor to pass, scrutinizing him curiously the while. Perhaps he might hope to find the good nature of an artist, or to receive the good offices of an amateur not unfriendly to the arts. But besides an almost diabolical expression in the face that met his gaze, there was that indescribable something which has an irresistible attraction for artists. Picture that face. A bald, high forehead and rugged jutting brows above a small flat nose turned up at the end, as in the portraits of Socrates and Rabelais. Deep lines about the mocking mouth, a short chin, carried proudly, covered with a grizzled, pointed beard, sea-green eyes that age might seem to have dimmed were it not for the contrast between the iris and the surrounding mother-of-pearl tints, so that it seemed as if under the stress of anger or enthusiasm there would be a magnetic power to quell or kindle in their glances. The face was withered beyond wont by the fatigue of years, yet it seemed aged still more by the thoughts that had worn away both soul and body. There were no lashes to the deep-set eyes, and scarcely a trace of the arching lines of the eyebrows above them. Set this head on a spare and feeble frame, place it in a frame of lace wrought like an engraved silver fish slice, imagine a heavy gold chain over the old man's black doublet, and you will have some dim idea of this strange personage, who seemed still more fantastic in the sombre twilight of the staircase. One of Rembrandt's portraits might have stepped down from its frame to walk in an appropriate atmosphere of gloom, such as the great painter loved. The older man gave the younger a shrewd glance and knocked thrice at the door. It was opened by a man of 40 or thereabout, who seemed to be an invalid. "Good day, master." Porbus bowed respectfully and held the door open for the younger man to enter, thinking that the latter accompanied his visitor, and when he saw that the neophyte stood a while as if spellbound, feeling, as every artist nature must feel, the fascinating influence of the first sight of a studio in which the material processes of art are revealed, Porbus troubled himself no more about this second comer. All the light in the studio came from a window in the roof, and was concentrated upon an easel where a canvas stood untouched as yet save for three or four outlines in chalk. The daylight scarcely reached the remoter angles and corners of the vast room. They were as dark as night, but the silver ornamented breastplate of a writer's corselet that hung upon the wall attracted a stray gleam to its dim abiding place among the brown shadows, or a shaft of light shot across the carved and glistening surface of an antique sideboard covered with curious silver plate, or struck out a line of glittering dots among the raised threads of the golden warp of some old brocaded curtains, where the lines of the stiff, heavy folds were broken as the stuff had been flung carelessly down to serve as a model. Plaster écorché stood about the room, and here and there, on shelves and tables, lay fragments of classical sculpture torsos of antique goddesses, worn smooth as though all the years of the centuries that had passed over them had been lovers' kisses. The walls were covered, from floor to ceiling, with countless sketches in charcoal, red chalk, or pen and ink. Amid the litter and confusion of colour boxes, overturned stools, flasks of oil and essences, there was just room to move so as to reach the illuminated circular space where the easel stood. The light from the window in the roof fell full upon Porbus's pale face and on the ivory-tinted forehead of his strange visitor. But in another moment the younger man heeded